So we're going to continue and look at the empire. Now, of course, the empire is tremendously important to Cook, because without the empire, no Cook, no expedition. We look at the background a little bit. In 1452, the Pope issued a papal bull, and this is the one, called Dom Diversas, and this granted Portugal and Spain, and I quote, full and free permission to invade, search out, capture, and subjugate unbelievers and enemies of Christ, wherever they may be, and to reduce them into perpetual slavery. Okay, I hate it when people do that. Although later popes will denounce the excesses of slavery, the origins are there. This is the whole idea unbelievers. So the division is Christians and non-Christians. Interesting point here, because although Cook is a Christian, and I think this would be worth studying, I'm not sure we have time to study it in particular, but I think it's worth a comment. Although Cook is a Christian, he doesn't talk much about God. Look at the entire journal. Now, okay, it's a journal which, especially at the beginning, is written for his bosses. Yeah? So he doesn't necessarily have to get carried away into religious lyricism. But by the end of the book, it is written for the public. The last voyage, he knows it's going to be published and will be read by a lot of people. And still, God is not very present. I was a little surprised by this. I would expect there to be more God's presence. So, perhaps he wasn't as religious as all that. In 1492, Columbus reached the Americas and he performed a ceremony to take possession of all lands discovered. This is the word he used, discovered, meaning all territory not occupied by Christians. And as we know, the result for Native Americans was not good. Although the result for Native Americans was very varied. Sometimes they were obliged to live in villages and become Christians. Often they were killed accidentally by diseases. And also frequently they just went out and hunted them and exterminated them, finding some sort of excuse. Just after Columbus, here we have the tomb of Christopher Columbus in Seville Cathedral, and that is a really cool tomb. Yeah, it's an amazing tomb. I've been there to Seville Cathedral. If you're going to die, do it properly. Yeah? Nobody in London has such a wonderful tomb as that. It's really cool. So 1494, the Treaty of Tordesillas, Tordesillas, declared that only non-Christian lands may be colonized. And it divided newly discovered lands outside Europe between the Portuguese Empire and the Spanish Empire. So this is the time the end of the 14th century. Spain and Portugal, they're the big players, they're the big bosses. In fact, Britain is a late comer to empire. In any case, there is a line defined by the treaty which says, if it's on the left, it's Spanish, if it's on the right, it's Portuguese. And this is why Brazil is Portuguese, for example, Portuguese-speaking today. In 1562, the French have an expedition to Florida. And there's a certain number of things going on. But even the history of Australia, and here we're getting much closer to Cook. In fact, I think the talk I gave on the century is the furthest away from Cook I will get. We're coming back more central here. Let's have a look at this. That looks kind of familiar. Isn't that Australia? Yes, it is Australia. And there is William Janszoon in 1605. And he landed in Australia in 1606. Have you ever heard of this gentleman? No. So how are we going to fit this in with this? Well, Cook discovered Australia. Well, he wasn't the first. So Willem Janszoon, as his name suggests, he is Dutch. Yeah, he is Dutch. He crossed over and he landed on the western shore of Cape York in Queensland He is the first recorded European to land on Australian soil. He was searching for gold, but he reported that the country was full of savage, cruel black barbarians who killed some of his men. So, that's the first. And here's another one, Tasman. Now, he sounds kind of familiar. Tasman, Tasmania. It's the name of the place, isn't it? I knew this. Let's have a look what Tasman did. 1642, 1644. This is still a long time before Captain Cook, and you can see him going over, having a look at Tonga, having a look at New Zealand, Tasmania, that's in the first voyage. Let's say expedition, let's not be unfair on Cook. And in the second one, you can see he's gone all along the top of Australia. This is the reason that Cook will take possession of the whole eastern sea line. Because he has an idea when somebody else has been there first. There were also people from Indonesia, not Europeans, people from Indonesia who visited the north of Australia. Indonesia, you can see it just at the top. They visited the north of Australia every year, for over 400 years. Okay, it's not so far. And of course, the whole idea of discovery is that it's got to be Christians discovering non-Christian lands. That's what it means, the discovery doctrine. And so the Indonesians didn't count. But the difference was, if you look at these people, Jans, Tasman, and the Indonesians, none of these people claimed possession of any part of Australia. So here we have a context for Cook claiming possession, because here's a clue. If you ever turn up on a continent that nobody's ever been to and you want to claim possession for it, it's better if you have a powerful navy behind you. Basically, Cook could claim possession because the British Empire was powerful. There's no point. I mean, I could claim possession, but, you know, nobody, who cares? You know, nobody listens to me. So that's what's going on here. And these wonderful voyages, okay, it's pretty powerful exploration, and they're pretty good at it. Nevertheless, they're not the only ones. Let's have a look at the Ming voyages from China in the 15th century, and you can see that they get all the way to East Africa, which is quite a long way if you don't have an aeroplane, which they didn't. So what we're saying here really is that this is again to go against some of the hagiography, yeah, that he was not particularly first, but his taking possession was realistic because there was an empire behind, and as we shall see, perhaps to our surprise, an empire that was coming quite quickly. You know, the penal colony and the colonization of New Zealand came quite quickly. I mean, you know, within 100 years, that's quickly in history. And so they became something, in particular because, of course, the Americans became independent. Let's move on then to some particular events around empire, and I'll talk about the Seven Years' War. The Seven Years' War began in 1754 and ended in 1763. Yes, that is 9 years. I'm sorry about this, but the Seven Years' War lasted more than 7 years. What can you do? Britain was at war with Spain and with France before, but in the Seven Years' War, they changed alliances. They changed alliances, but France was still on the other side. Conflict began in 1754 with British attacks on disputed French positions in North America. The Seven Years' War, and here you have an example of one of the battles, the Battle of Quiberon, 1759. 400 British died, 2,500 French died. I wanted to give a bit of numbers because we sometimes think that because we're 21st century and 20th century, we sometimes think that we invented horrible wars. They were already pretty horrible. Yeah? 18th century war are no fun. For example, you can... go down at sea and everybody drown. Yeah, okay. Or you can all burn to death. Because one of the favourite tactics in the naval battle is the fire ship. You set an old ship on fire and you send it towards your enemies. So it was not that much fun. The Seven Years' War was the first global war between England and France for empire. It spanned five continents. At this time, England had a population of 8 million. Just England, not England and Scotland. France far more, but the technology was better in Britain. And by 1756, the English navy was far stronger than the French. There was a battle in Menorca against the French. The French won this battle. In 1756, the French won the battle in Menorca. The British Admiral, John Byng, was executed, not by the French, by his own government for incompetence. C'est sûr que parfois le code du travail à l'époque, je vous dis pas. Okay. So this was pretty serious stuff. This is pretty serious stuff. When you're executing your admirals, this is serious war, yeah. Il n'y a pas beaucoup d'exemples, même au XXe siècle, d'exécuter le chef. Stalin surtout. Hein, Stalin. Peut-être les Japonais, j'en sais rien. Je ne m'y connais pas. Oui, je pense que souvent c'est les suicides plutôt. Mais je ne m'y connais pas. Par contre, Staline, c'était une habitude. Interesting enough, John Byng, the admiral who was executed for incompetence, in much later, his descendants petitioned the government for a posthumous pardon in 2007. They petitioned. You know, my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was executed and I want him pardoned. Well, that's just an anecdote. It doesn't care. It doesn't matter. Yeah, the naval battles of the 18th century were pretty vicious. Once the British had established naval superiority at sea, the British made a series of impressive gains at the expense of France. Slaving stations in West Africa, sugar islands in the Caribbean, and large parts of India all came under British control. In 1758, the British mounted attack on New France. And on the 13th of September 1759, General James Wolfe, there he is, defeated the French at Quebec. And by the autumn of 1760, French America had become British. And that's why Canada is still mostly English-speaking. The moment when Cook decided to join the Royal Navy was before this war. But everybody knew the war was coming. So one of the interesting questions, if once we get to the part about the man, why did James Cook join the Navy when there was a war on the way? I'm not saying we can answer the question, yeah? But of course, young people do this all the time. Hey, you know, unless there's a war on, you know, let's join the army. Yeah. The Seven Years' War ended with the Treaty of Paris, signed in 1763. And it ended French colonial power in North America. And also reduced massively French colonial power in India. Et en Inde, je pense que ça va être réduit jusqu'à Pondichéry, et c'est à peu près tout. Hein. And the Portuguese will have Goa, and c'est à peu près tout. The English will get India, which is big. But the French did manage to keep... So first of all, I have this wonderful painting of the death of General James Wolfe. He won a battle and then died in the next battle. And here you have a heroic picture of General Wolfe dying. Of course, with the flag. And you notice the Native Americans watching. The Seven Years' War is known in the United States as the French and Indian War. It's the same war, it's another name. Because the Native Americans were important and they made an alliance with one side and then made an alliance with the other side. They played it very well. They played one against the other. I say this because very often in history books, which are still rather colonialist, the idea that the Native Americans made decisions and did things is not always but remembered. However, the French were allowed to keep something. There it is, Saint-Pierre et Miquelon. Now, the only reason we know of its existence is because it's on the météo every now and then on the telly, isn't it? You know, and I'm not sure if I knew where it was. Okay. The other big fact about the 17th century is the slave trade. And interestingly enough, I think that in school history, people talk a lot about the abolition of the slave trade and not so much about the slave trade, which is understanding because it's understandable because it's depressing. Between 1600 and 1850, about 12 million Africans were shipped across the Atlantic from West Africa to European colonies. The British perfected during the 18th century the Atlantic slave system. British merchants transported almost 3 million enslaved Africans. There's a lot of work being done on this at the moment in museums. And for example, where museums used to talk about slaves, they now use a different vocabulary. They say enslaved Africans. And it's not quite the same. It's because slaves was always used as a commercial term. You know, a million slaves, I'll have 100 slaves. And so the use of the word, the expression enslaved Africans, is an attempt to have a more direct view of what's really going on. Yeah. In particular, because we have very little voices from the slaves who were on the ships. They couldn't read and write, so we don't know what they thought. In the 1790s, there were 20,000 black people living in London. Not a huge community, but nevertheless. The slave trade was absolutely central to the British Industrial Revolution. The money. It was a huge amount of money. We would probably have had an industrial revolution without the money made from the slave trade, but it would have been later and not as thoroughgoing. During the 18th century, sugar became enormously popular. It was very expensive at the beginning as well. Sugar, we forget sugar is not expensive today. You know, if you know somebody say, oh, you know, I don't have enough to buy sugar, they really have a very serious financial problem. The heightened demand for production of sugar transformed the eating habits of Europeans. They began consuming jam, sweets, tea, etc. And the islands of the Caribbean produced up to 90% of the sugar for Western Europe. The laws in the British West Indies were extremely cruel. If a slave hit a white man, they would cut his hand off. Slave women were institutionally raped. It was quite traditional for a white man to have a slave every birthday. To have a slave too that they could rape. The children of slaves were automatically slaves, but quite often their father was the white slave master. And so this caused a lot of problems. Indeed, in the 1760s, the House of Assembly in British Jamaica made it illegal to leave money to the children of slave women. Because sometimes the white master, would leave money to his children who were the children of slaves, and this became illegal because the white elite were terrified of the possibility of there being a black middle class. So horrible, horrible story, which I can't, I've got two more pages of horrible things here. I think the most important thing is the amount of money. Two things. The population of about 25 million in 1850 in Western Central Africa was probably about half of what it would have been if there hadn't been the slave trade. So it destroyed the African civilization. But also in Britain, the money was everywhere. Because slavery is so horrible, we sometimes get the impression that it's like, you know, today you have the drug trade, heroin trade, horrible criminals making lots of money from a horrible trade. The slave trade wasn't like that at all. The slave trade was completely respectable. For 100 years, every Lord Mayor of London had money in the slave trade. It was not a horrible, marginal thing. Middle-class shopkeepers invested some money in a slave ship. I think they did. Now, these are all huge questions that it brings up because, you know, people are occasionally tempted to say, well, it was accepted at the time, that people thought it was okay at the time. Well, of course, this depends who you ask. The slaves didn't think it was okay, but they didn't get to say much. So I think that's the most important thing about the slave trade, that it was everywhere. Gladstone's father, That is the great politician Gladstone. His father wrote a famous pro-slavery column in the Liverpool Mercury. In the 1780s, just the time of Cook, the Church of England was the biggest owner of slaves in Barbados. The Church of England. Indeed, in 2006, the Church of England officially apologised. Okay, on peut pas dire qu'ils étaient pressés. This is a history which is not finished. I can't remember who it was who said that the past is never forgotten. It isn't even past. I can't remember somebody said that. This is why we are not surprised to see Cook say nothing about slavery when he comes across slaves. There's a point where, I can't remember where it is, where he's having his ship repaired and there are some slaves, not his slaves there, local slaves involved, and that's not, you know, it's not nothing unusual, nothing shocking. If I remember correctly, on his second voyage, Cook was very angry because the book published about his first voyage mixed things up, and in particular, it sometimes took things which Joseph Banks had said. And in the book, it says James Cook said. This was one of the things that made Cook angry. And if I remember correctly, one of the things which was said is that Joseph Banks said that the people in this place treat their slaves with great cruelty. And in the book, it said James Cook said this. So that was something going on. So Cook will say that he disapproves of cannibalism when he sees ritual cannibalism, but he will never say anything against slavery. In any case, it has to be said that if you are the captain of a British Empire ship, being opposed to slavery, yeah, it's not really possible. It's an extremist political position at the time. Slave rebellions were quite common. For example, on the ship Marlborough in 1752, the slaves revolted and killed most of the crew and forced the remaining ones to take them home to Africa. And there's slaves on the trip, on the ship. In the islands, slaves ran away and established their own communities in the mountains of the West Indies. And here we have a slave, a modern monument to a slave revolt. This particular one is Dutch. In 1787, so just after Cook died, you have the establishment of the Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. At the first meeting, they had 12 people, and everybody considered they were just mad. And they decided that they were going to abolish the slave trade. But they were people with a vision. And here is a couple of the things they used. Propaganda for the middle class is the teapot. Health to the sick, honour to the brave, success to the lover, and freedom to the slave. And on the other side, you see a boycott glass, which says, East Indian sugar not made by slaves. They had a campaign that said, don't buy your sugar from here, because it's made by slaves, buy it from here. Of course, this is what we call a boycott, but the word boycott was not invented until much later. Another symbol of the time is that this is about the time of the Tramalin events. I don't know if you know about this. This is 1761. Was that ever entendu parler?
Yeah, there was a series of documentary.
There was, yes. Yeah, there was, yeah. And there was an exhibition which I saw in Bordeaux. It's a very simple story. The reason it's important is because we have a lot of evidence. Whereas there are a lot of other stories, we lost them. Basically, it's a French ship full of slaves, and their ship is wrecked. First of all, most of the slaves die because they refuse to let them out of the hole, of the hold in the bottom of the ship, so they just leave the slaves to drown. And then they all arrive on an island, 122 sailors and 60 slaves, and out of the wreck they make another boat, and all the white people go away, and they say, we'll come back and save you later. And they don't come back. And they come back like 30 years later, and there are three survivors. The other reason it's important is that they recently, in the last 20 years, they have done, because this is a deserted island, nobody lives there. So recently they've done archaeology on the island and discovered loads of things about how they lived when there were 60 of them surviving for 30 years. And these were people who didn't know the sea. They were taken from a part of Africa where they weren't in the sea. And so it's how they... So it obviously it's symbolic of how people were not very nice to slaves. Okay. Okay, there's two more bits of the empire I just want to look at. First of all, British America. This is absolutely the moment. And indeed, at one point, when Captain Cook discovers an English ship, he gets the news, and the news is that it's okay, that the Americans have calmed down and we're not at war anymore. The calm won't last very long. Of course, they're going to be independent soon. The 7 Years' War had been very expensive, and so the British government wanted the Americans to pay more taxes, and that led to a slow rise of a movement of white colonists saying no taxation without representation, of course, because they had no members of parliament in London. And this led to a gradual intensification of the conflict, where the British government passed, first of all, new taxes and then new repressive legislation. And finally, there was, the gunshot that went around the world, something like that, was the slogan, where you, for the first time, the British shoot an American. But at the time, this is amazingly shocking, because the Americans, most of them think of themselves as British. They live in America, but they're British. They're British Americans. Yeah. And so this was a tremendous shock. And this will lead us to, very slowly then, to 1776. and the Declaration of Independence. And finally, followed by a war. And 1783, Britain signs the Treaty of Paris, recognizing American independence. And the British evacuate New York. So all of these things are going on. This is a loss of a huge colony, a huge and extremely rich colony. There was a huge amount of money being made from the south, tobacco and later cotton, especially tobacco. Tobacco is big money. And there was a huge amount of money being made in the north. How did they make the money in the north? Fish. Cod was another huge world changer. But when they arrived, they couldn't believe it was so easy to catch fish in North America, and that also helped life expectancy. So they lost this huge thing, so they were desperate to get more rich places to make money from. And the other thing that was going on at exactly the same time is British India, the history of British India. Now British India was a little unusual at the time. So that's the Boston Tea Party. There's your slide of the Boston Tea Party. And there is the Battle of Lexington, and I was straight onto India. The colonization of India was done in a rather unusual way. The British monarchy established a commercial company and said, you have the monopoly on trading with India. It's yours. It's a kind of privatized sort of colonization. And then a little later, when the company said, oh, well, can we make our own money? Can we print our own money and organize the money? And the government said, yeah, okay. And a bit later, the East India Company said, can we have our own army? Yeah, okay. So you actually had a private company with an army and producing currency, which controlled an enormous country. They made huge fortunes. Be it when you're a young man from the elites, from the aristocracy or the bourgeoisie, you go out to India for a few years, and you come back a millionaire. Sometimes from the diamond mines. In fact, one of the biggest diamonds in the world, which is at the moment in Paris, was taken from India by the British, by an individual British person. I can't remember its name. But not by the government, by an individual, something like this. Amazing, isn't it? It's priceless. Now, at this time, however, the East India Company is having some problems, and in 1773, so exactly in the middle of Cook, you have Lord North's India Bill. For the first time, the government attempts to regulate the business of the East India Company. And the British government establishes a Supreme Court for British India. A few years later, the 1784 Pitt's India Act gave more power to the state and less to the company. The British argued about the best way to rule India. And they did it in a very philosophical way. First of all, the utilitarians, looking apparently for the greatest happiness of the greatest number, dominated the administration of England, of India. And for example, they banned evangelism. Christian evangelism was banned until 1813. So, no, leave them their own, you know, leave them their own religion. That doesn't matter. We're making lots of money from them. That's the main thing. But after 1800, there was a rise of evangelism, and that was one of the reasons for the enormous revolt of 1857. Well, that's much later. At this time, then, the first Governor General was created. The first job, 1773, the job was invented, Governor General. So what was happening is that the British government was gradually taking money away from the East India Company and power away from the East India Company and having it itself. And in all of this, nobody thought the Indians should have any choice. This is important because when we see the attitude of the Admiralty and of Cook and of Cook's officers to the native peoples they encounter, it's very clear that although we regularly hear the quotations when he says, oh, they're very clever, these native people, it's very, very clear that he thinks that the Westerners are superior. It's not controversial. He just does. And we're not surprised by this because at this time, British colonialism controls many tens of millions of people in India with no question, no question of democracy, no question of an Indian middle class. Indians cannot be lawyers, cannot be doctors. They import their civil service. Literally, all the managers are imported from England, all of them. In the army, you have the army, which is Indian soldiers with British officers. So it's just very clear. In the 1760s, the East India Company formally gained the right to tax Bengal. Bengal is an enormous area of India. Over the next few years, from 1769 to 73, there was the Great Bengal Famine. 10 million people died. And during this period, the East Indian Company continued making the taxes higher. They're increasing the taxation during the famine, in particular land tax. And secondly, they organized the destruction of traditional food crops for cash crops. The East India Company wanted crops. What do they want? They wanted indigo for dyeing textiles for the wool industry in Britain. And secondly, not yet. As far as I understand, not yet. I'm not certain. Opium. Yeah. This was big money. Opium poppies. Remember, you know, loads of people were addicted to opium in Britain, but also in China in particular. So, in this context, the objectives of Cook's expeditions are easy to understand. The British Empire could benefit hugely if a new southern continent could be taken possession of, the aim of the first two expeditions. And similarly, the trade advantage possible in discovering a northwest passage from the Pacific to the Atlantic. This is big money. It's not just for the fun. It's similar to much later, in the 19th century, you have the Suez Canal. If you want to go to India, you can go round Africa. It's a long way. You go round Africa. So the Suez Canal was to transform the entire world economy, in fact. You know, and certainly the Panama Canal, much later still. And there you have the Great Bengal Famine. Well, and I just have time to say something nice about a Frenchman. It's always nice to say something nice about a Frenchman. Good old Lapeyrouse. There he is. There is a Lapeyrouse museum somewhere in Brittany, which I went to, but I can't remember where it is. I love museums. I go to the maximum number of museums. So here is good old La Perouse. Now this is later, 1785. Yeah, just a few years later, 1785 to 1880. La Perouse, who went round the world, he did a pretty long. He disappeared and died. Sorry about that, but he did get quite a long way. Fortunately for somebody, at some point, I can't remember where, he manages to send his diaries back. So we have the journals, but we don't have La Perouse. He just had a bad time, like you can. So he sailed around the world from 1785. Et dans son texte, il dit, il visait à remplir les blancs de Cook. Et aussi ramener les Français au premier plan. Come on. Who is on board? The reason I mentioned it is because Bougainville and La Perouse, Bougainville is just before, and La Perouse is just after. And so this allows us to compare some things. This is important because when Cook does certain things, we don't know if it's typical or not. It's just one example. So La Perouse, for example, his ship also was full of scientists, astronomers, mathematicians, draftsmen, that's artists. The ship artist was tremendously important, of course. They don't have an iPhone to take photographs with. So the ship artist was really an extremely important person, not just also to help to draw the maps and to draw the coastline, because you know, if you say they're very dangerous cliffs, you want pictures of them, and of course for the natural history side of it. Lots of botanists. And he was looking very much also for selling furs was important. And I think I mentioned this last week as well. Today, des fourrures, bon, c'est un objet de luxe, tout le monde s'en fiche un peu. This is not the case at the time. Furs is very big money and very useful. It keeps people alive in the winter. So there's something there. He sets off, La Perouse sets off with the map drawn by Cook, and also with a map drawn by the Spanish. This is important, the exchange of ideas and information. Cook also shows at several points in his journal that he has read the books by other expeditions. Yeah, they don't want to take any risks. They are risking their lives. I think the other thing that's interesting is that I think it's La Perouse whose ships are called La Boussole and L'Astrolabe. I think that's La Perouse. It might be Bougainville. I get them mixed up. Can somebody check that for me? No, that's okay. I'll do it. I think I could do it. Expedition de La Perouse. Oui, c'est ça. Boussole et Astrolabe are the name of his ships. Now notice Cook, Endeavour, Resolution, Adventure. Say again?
Another navigator uses to name his boat as well, Dumont-Durville.
Ah, really? What used what? Like Astrolabe? Uh-huh. But it's not the same style, is it? Resolution, adventure. Oh, it's all British. So there is something there, you know, there is something there. It's well known that the British and the French are the two most arrogant nations in the world. But in slightly different ways. We each have our own specialities there. It's still... Oh, that's cool. That's great. Okay, and I just got just in time to the end of my notes on the empire, and there we're closer to Cook because we have a general context of what the British elite would like to do. But at the same time, and I think this was a very, very important point, that all this amateurism. Yeah, that they're not saying, all right, okay, let's get everybody together, okay, where shall we colonise next? It really doesn't work like that. Even the colonisation of Australia is to solve another problem. We need, look, the French have come and done a prison in New Caledonia. That's a pretty good idea, isn't it? Having prisons a long time, a long way away. Where should we do it? Joseph Banks said, oh, well, Australia is very good for that. Or New Holland is very good for that. Oh, well, we'll try it. There's a whole load of accidental. Now, once the British had taken possession of Australia, colonisation was going to happen. But exactly when and exactly how was not fixed. Huh? It could have been 50 years later, and it could have been an agricultural colony and not a penal colony, and that would have changed a lot of things. Thank you very much.